You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA. You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA.
Hello and welcome to episode 442 of the Fabulous Pelton Cast, sponsored by our friends at Pagliacci Pizza. I'm your co-host, Kevin Pelton.
You want to start that over? Or are we rolling with it? Because I'm Tristan Caracino.
And we're coming to you in different locations this week. I'm in Seattle, Washington, home of the four-time WNBA champion, Storm.
I'm coming in from Renton, Washington, home of the Super Bowl 48 champion and consecutive game winning Seattle Seahawks.
You undersold it, sir. It's home of the NFC West leading.
Your first place.
Seattle
Seahawks. NFC West, Seattle Seahawks. And it's a special one because it's the Vin Baker edition.
That's interesting because I was so focused on the fact that it's the soccer edition of the Pelton Cast, 4-4-2. Although a lineup that Brian Schmetzer does not really deploy at any point, the 4-4-2.
I like that
not
one.
His favorite.
It's fun when we can incorporate all three numbers and not just the last two numbers. Like
I agree.
Into the 3-6-0 edition.
Because we've repeated many of them. I mean, all of them. I don't know. I guess new numbers are coming all the time. So, you know, maybe
like
next
people
time.
People are inventing new numbers?
No. Like when we get to episode 512, it's going to be the Denzel Bots 10 edition.
Oh, you're saying players are doing things along
the
way. That's how little we recognize
it's going to be the Jonah Coleman edition. Well, yes. But I'm just saying, what's the new hotness?
I would love for you to find out when the episode 512 is going to be. If it's not during Husky football season, and this is no offense to Denzel Boston, I do not think we're going to call it the Denzel Boston edition.
Yeah, it should be occurring sometime in February.
There we go.
Give or take. Maybe March.
That's February of 2026?
Yes.
Okay. Well, maybe Denzel Boston will be about to be drafted.
Yeah, it could be exciting. Yeah.
Maybe Denzel Boston will have just won the national championship.
Let's wish it into existence. I wanted to shout out our sponsors.
I said maybe.
Pagliacci. I had Pagliacci for dinner tonight. It was great.
Hello.
The Italiano, wildly underrated. We do our search for Seattle's best slice. I think the Italiano is going to go farther than people expect in their mock brackets, which obviously people will be concocting and playing along at home.
Oh, yeah. Pagliacci Italiano.
So the Italiano
is going to come up with an opera when I Google that.
Yes, I think that is quite likely. It's the spinach and garlic, actual cloves of garlic on there. So
I'm kind of surprised by this. These sound like a lot of things that you don't eat.
What? Spinach?
Yeah.
Why wouldn't I eat spinach? I've had spinach two nights in a row, good sir.
Oh, it popped up with the Chanterelle Prosciutto Primo, which top notch. But Autumn Harvest, the Chanterelle one, phenomenal.
Yeah, this is not a special. It's just today is the day it's on the slice bar, the Italiano. Also,
you know,
having
I've,
been
I've
to
had it,
Italy.
I haven't had it that many times. Oh, my God. That's why you had to pick the Italiano.
No.
Like,
I was liking the Italiano.
Like I'm home a little bit more.
We really have so much to get to, but I want to do.
I love how much we've built this.
10 seconds on the.
It's not we. It's you. Literally, are still doing this.
I mean, it's like self-referentially doing it at this point. It's not like I'm just like accidentally. Oh, I didn't mean to reference going to Italy.
It's like the flicker.
Yes, it's very much like the flicker, which you're never gonna let that. So when you get an Italian, did I bring this up on the pod? When you get an Italian sandwich,
oh God,
in the
I'm
United
sure you
States,
did, but I don't recall.
It's like cold cuts,
yeah,
basically. But in the Italiano, when you go to a sandwich shop in Italy, is it means you're gonna get prosciutto, you're gonna get like cheese and then tomatoes. That's the three ingredients you're gonna have on there on the Italiano.
Okay.
So that is like a specific style there that is different than what it is in the, and that was my go-to default, even though I would ask for it senza tomate.
Oh God, of course.
Pomodori, I should say.
So naturally, you don't eat tomatoes.
Well, you know.
Italiano sandwich. I'm Googling this.
I'm curious what's gonna come up.
Probably an opera. Well, there's a thing called a main Italian sandwich, which comes up. It's like a sub sandwich with, it looks like
a grinder.
Pesto. Yeah, more like a grinder. Yeah, I think you're probably right because there's a bunch of different variations. There's not like you don't Google Italiano sandwich and just that comes up. This right. may be a thing that's more specific to Italy, but for the American mind, we think of like more general.
But it is funny because the joke is always like, well, in Canada, they don't call it Canadian bacon. They just call it bacon. But in this case, even the Italians call something the Italiano.
I mean, we have American cheese in
it's
America.
True.
It's not like you don't.
But you understand the joke. You understand the joke.
Yeah, it's a really good one. The joke is All that right. you're still talking about going to Italy like yeah. 3 months later.
That is the joke. I agree. I'm very good at it. So are you.
Let's very good at it.
Let's get into referencing it. Let's get into this week's toast, starting with wishing everyone a happy Thanksgiving. And we will, as always. I don't think we're going to have the time to like plug it in on the back end and make this a 3-hour podcast. But we will, of course, link to our Thanksgiving food special with Nate Duncan of the Dunked On Basketball NBA podcast. So everyone can give that a listen as part of their holiday travels.
There we go.
Well, we start on a sad note this week as we are saying a possible farewell to Sam Haggerty, one of four players who was non-tendered by the Mariners ahead of Friday's deadline. Haggerty, of course, still rehabbing the Achilles rupture he suffered playing for Tacoma last season. It wouldn't be shocking to see him come back to the Mariners on a minor league deal that just he wouldn't take up a spot on the 40-man roster. But for now, Sam Haggerty, a free agent. You're just too sad.
Hold on. I know we've had our squabbles, Jerry DePoto. But this is a bridge too far, Jerry. Not selling out one of your brethren. You were supposed to have every Italian player in the majors on the Mariners. That's why you're here, Jerry. It's the lone redeeming quality right now. With no Haggerty, what even is this Mariners team?
It's a great question. It's a very fair question. All right, congrats to Seattle Sounders FC.
Jerry DePoto probably thinks an Italiano sandwich is a grinder with pesto on it. He probably thinks
even
it's from Maine.
To Italy. Congrats to Seattle Sounders FC, who reached the Western Conference Finals for the seventh time in the last 12 seasons with Saturday's 2-1 road win after extra time over LAFC. They did it. They pulled off the upset. We'll talk more about this matchup as we get to the Sounders section in the roundup, but wanted to shout that out right at the beginning.
I was telling Jan, she was saying that she was like, I'm sorry that I don't listen to the podcast. And I was like, first off, that's fine. Intentionally small. Not interested in you listening, Jan. Second off, I was like, there's like a bunch of esoteric sports talk that wouldn't really mean anything to you. And then Jan said, what does esoteric mean? And I was thinking about us getting angry at Jerry DePoto because the Seattle Sports Podcast also happens to be interested in Italian things. That is a very specific thing that you have to be part of a group of people to understand what is going on and why.
She might get the wanting Italians on the Mariners part of it. I think that we wouldn't have to sell her on. Still upset that Chris Bozzio isn't around.
That's Mariners legend Chris Bozzio for you.
Congrats to Earl Thomas and Ricky Waters, who advanced as among the 25 modern era semifinalists for the Pro Football Hall of Fame class of 2025. Unfortunately, Marshawn Lynch did not make the list in his first year of eligibility.
Is that something? How many years does he have?
Infinite. It's not like baseball where there's a specific limit. I mean, I guess at some point you cross over from the modern era to the non-modern era, but obviously Ricky Waters has been retired a long period of time.
A long time. Okay. Marshawn Lynch will be in the Hall of Fame eventually.
But it does seem that's the general consensus. I know that we looked this up a few weeks ago when the nominees were first announced, or quarterfinalists, I don't know, whatever the previous round is.
Part of the Hall of Fame is about your impact on the sport. And back-to-back weeks in 2024, we saw Marshawn Lynch's impact.
Our Marshawn Lynch year.
The most Marshawn Lynch of all years. We saw Marshawn Lynch's impact on the sport of football. No offense to Ricky Waters, but like people are not doing any Ricky Waters celebration almost at a decade later, more than a decade later, I think, the first time, right?
No, so I will give Ricky Waters credit for the indelible phrase For who, for what?
For who, for what? For us, we're the only ones who really know that phrase because of Les Carpenter. But
I think national people know that too. It's out there. But obviously, we're talking indelible phrases. I'm just here so I don't won't get fined. Is up
exactly.
there too.
He's got more. Marshawn Lynch as a personality, it is the Hall of Fame. People get so caught up in hits and shit like that, in raw stats. And it's like, not that I'm talking about anybody, but people get so caught up in these raw stats and try to understand the cultural impact. I posted this in the Discord earlier, some of the baseball cards that I had, and I pulled out the Ken Griffey Jr. baseball card of him blowing the bubble gum, and I was just like, it's the greatest baseball card of all time. Like, that. Not that anybody would dispute Ken Griffey Jr. being in the Hall of Fame, but
like his rookie card?
No, the one of him blowing the bubble in the locker room. He has the hat backwards. It's like a fake bubble, but it's like
in Upper Deck?
One of the most iconic moments. I don't think it is Upper Deck. I can grab it in a second, but it is like one of the most iconic moments in baseball history, this baseball card. That's the kind of shit you have to do to be in the Hall of Fame. It's more than just fucking raw stats. The baseball nerds ruin everything.
I mean, I don't think it necessarily is more.
Except for sometimes how to approach the sport of baseball. I'm fine. I'm with the baseball nerds on. But the like apples to apples shit, that's what's annoying.
I'm not quite sure what that means. But I don't know if you've read the second half of this toast. Because baseball Hall of Fame ballots went out this week or last week, because I wrote this note last week before we decided to do an abbreviated pod before the flicker, including... Both Felix Hernandez and
the flicker
Ichiro
heard around the world.
Certainly heard around the sound as first time nominees. So it's not exactly news. It's well established when those players are first on the ballot. But there you go. This is the first year of eligibility. And the question, as far as I can tell with Ichiro, is whether he will be voted unanimously to the Baseball Hall of Fame.
Okay, here's the thing. I've been workshopping being fine with Ichiro. I've just basically I spend way too much time thinking about Ichiro. And it's kind of like, I don't need to do this. Ichiro was a good baseball player. I think Ichiro for a period of time was slightly overrated. And that's basically where the argument ends, right? And I think it's almost inarguable that Ichiro was at least a slightly overrated baseball player as far as his impact with wins and losses.
Yes, I think that is a reasonable argument.
That's it. So I've been workshopping, just letting it go, me and my Ichiro beef, because he is a Hall of Fame baseball player. And the more different ways that I look at it, trying to hate on Ichiro, I'm like, I'm coming purely from the perspective of hate. So... don't think that my point of view has changed. I basically am just like, Ichiro is good enough. He had a good enough career to be in the Hall of Fame. And I actually, taking a step back, I think Ichiro has a couple of moments, not a ton, he has a couple of moments that are Hall of Fame worthy moments, right? There's like gutting down the runner at third.
The throw.
Ichiro, again, he doesn't have a ton, but Ichiro probably... I'm gonna transform my Ichiro position from disliking Ichiro to disliking the Seattle Mariners organization.
That's a much more popular take. I think that's a great decision on your part.
And look, I'm saying that Ichiro was he represented a time period that the Mariners got too popular. But
I mean, it is true. If Ichiro is unanimously voted in the Hall of Fame and Ken Griffey Jr. was not, that would qualify as being overrated.
Exactly.
Even though Did the Japanese accomplishments count towards the Pro Baseball Hall of Fame? I don't know how that works.
I don't think they do. But Ichiro deserves to be in there. Unanimous doesn't make sense. Who's the last unanimous player was?
I don't know if it's happened. Or maybe it's happened, but not for a long
period.
Oh, Mariano Rivera was the only one.
Rivera
the first
was
one.
Unanimous?
Okay. Yes, in 2019. Ichiro says, according to Google AI, Ichiro is considered a strong candidate for unanimous election in the future. He's a beloved figure around the world, and his impact on the game extends beyond his MLB career. So there you go.
Again, I'm workshopping being fine with Ichiro. I've been thinking about it. I've been thinking about it a lot. But at the same time, to me, Felix Hernandez meant more as a Seattle Mariner. Felix Hernandez, I feel like Felix and Ken Griffey Jr. are kind of maybe Edgar in the mix, like they're the most emblematic of the Seattle Mariners in history, because Felix Hernandez really represents the futility.
Oh, and, without question.
And that's what I think, if you want to understand the Seattle Mariners experience, like it's not necessarily Ken Griffey Jr. Ken Griffey Jr. represents a different Seattle Mariners experience. He represented the moment that the futility stopped. And that's why Ken Griffey Jr., like not A-Rod, not Egger, not anybody else, is the basically the greatest Seattle Mariner of all time, because he personally ended the futility with everybody else. Felix, on the other hand, is one of us. Felix's life and his career is on the internet complaining about the Mariners trying to bring back Justin Turner or whatever.
I hope Felix is pro Justin Turner. Okay. Congrats to UW men's cross country, which won the West Region Championships for the second time in program history. We remain a cross country school.
It's faster school, you know, team from down south. They're just not a good running school.
They should get a little more speed in the athletic department.
Honestly, I'll give it up to them. Football's been pretty solid this year. It's been a solid season so far. But track and field is just not what they do. You have to understand what your wheelhouse is. And UW's just a track school. You know, we're fast. So,
Both UW men's and women's soccer saw their NCAA tournament runs end in the second round. The women lost 1-0 at Mississippi State on Friday, while the men lost 2-1 at SMU on Sunday.
Are we still on the toast right now?
We are still on the toast. It's a long toast.
Did you sneak a roundup into the toast?
It's 2 weeks worth of toast in some cases. We're saying farewell to Dave Sims, who's been hired by the Yankees. Is the replacement for John Sterling as radio play-by-play broadcaster? It's a return to the East Coast for the Philadelphia native who cut his teeth in New York radio. Sims had been with the Mariners since 2007. All right.
I mean, good for Dave Sims, though, to get that job. That's awesome. He's somebody who worked for it. This is not like I hope he goes 8-3 next year and loses 24-3 to Oklahoma. This is something Dave Sims worked for. He earned. He built it up. He was great in Seattle for a long, long time.
The voice of many iconic moments, including Felix Hernandez's perfect game, which he actually called on TV nationally, I believe, right?
Was that
Philip Humber's perfect game? I don't know. One of those he called nationally.
I'm one of the few people who enjoys hearing kind of like random stories about old baseball just because it's folksy.
Oh, bring back Dave Niehaus.
The people who want stats from their baseball announcers are just like, dog, we know. It's more fun for us to know. For some reason, I feel different about football. Like, because I think football sort of changes the narrative about the game. But in baseball, it's kind of like there's them and then there's us. When it comes to baseball, and there's almost more of us than there are of them now. So it's a little bit less fun. But like football, I think you want the commentators to have some idea what's going on.
Well, it's
but
also
maybe complaining
more
about it is part of it. You know, maybe them being like, oh, they really should kick here, is like, you got to play the field position game. Maybe that's part of the fun of watching football on TV, is getting angry about that.
Being part of the opposition. All right. I told you that we had a section full of toasts related to left-handed pitchers with ties to the city of Seattle.
Oh, I forgot I remember who the other one is now.
We start with congrats to Seattle U grad Tarek Skubal on winning AL Cy Young. Logan Gilbert finished sixth in the voting. Did you see that the Seattle U took out a full page ad in the Seattle Times?
I loved it. I love that Seattle U did that. That's awesome. Honestly, like it's probably one of the greatest moments in Seattle U sports history, at least for a very long time.
Yeah, I mean,
for them,
some respect on Elgin Baylor's name.
Yeah, no, but I mean, it's kind of like Elgin Baylor, Tarek Skubal. Like, that's kind of it.
The O'Brien brothers, you know.
So.
But it's been a minute. The other, of course, being Seattle native Blake Snell, who agreed on Tuesday night before we recorded this to a 5-year, $182 million contract with the Dodgers. And I think it's great for the Dodgers that finally they were able to address their weak starting rotation.
Yeah.
You know, it's nice to see teams able to finally get better.
Just like, they're adding Blake Snell and presumably Roky Sasaki in the same offseason after, like, I would say comfortably winning the World Series.
Yeah, I would say comfortable.
It's pretty nuts. Honestly, it's fun, though. Again, having villains is fun, and the Yankees weren't good enough at it.
Especially if those villains cannot beat you in the ALCS. Yes. Like, if the Mariners lose to the Dodgers, what an amazing outcome for the Mariners.
Yeah.
I know Pelton Cast Golden Rule and all. I guarantee you we'd be okay with the Mariners losing to the Dodgers. Do you want to do emergency pod style on Seahawks Cardinals? Semi-emergency pod?
Sure. Is that all? Are we done with the toast?
That is mercifully the end of the toast.
I think, yeah, okay, yeah, let's talk Seahawks Cardinals before we get into cookies and things.
Seahawks defense is amazing.
Could not agree more.
Wow, hard agree. I mean, all right, okay, I'll give you my number one take during this game, and then you can discuss the experience of actually being there as a fan. It's like, what an amazing 2 weeks for John Schneider. Like, on the eve of Seahawks 49ers, there was that whole leak about them almost drafting Debo Samuel. Like, they had the plan to draft Debo Samuel in addition to DK Metcalf, but their trade fell apart or whatever it was happened. It was like, this feels like the kind of thing you'd leak if you wanted to let everyone know that you were so good at GMing that you scouted Debo Samuel and DK Metcalf in the same draft. And maybe it's because you're feeling a little heat because of the fact that your team that you put together with your coach you chose is 4-5 and looking worse than that record. But 2 weeks later, the decision to fire Pete Carroll and hire Mike Macdonald looks incredible. This is everything you wanted to see from the Seahawks defense against their NFC West rivals. The Leonard Williams trade is suddenly redeemed. I'm like, that second round pick wasn't probably going to be that good anyway. The Ernest Jones the fourth trade, like,
I mean, we
looks
already
like
know who the
it's,
second round pick was, so we can already look at who the player was.
I mean, probably the Giants blew it. I don't know.
Oh
Unless it
yeah,
was Malik Nabers.
absolutely.
The Ernest Jones the fourth trade looks
Oh
like
yeah.
it saved the season instead of being a desperate attempt to get back into relevance in a season that was going nowhere. Like, all Devin Witherspoon, not that we were down on him, but it looks that much better 2 weeks later. Jaxon Smith-Njigba continues to look like a future star at wide receiver. Like, John Schneider, the meter has changed so quickly in the last 2 weeks.
It's pretty incredible. I think the best thing about there's all sorts of reasons why football is great, which was the witching hour this Sunday. It was one of those things back to back weeks. I've had moments where I was like, ah, oh, this is kind of a boring NFL Sunday. I'm watching Red Zone,
I
and
mean,
then
everyone thought it
bam,
was
you
going to
kidding
be
me?
like the worst slate of the early games.
It's just out of nowhere, all of a sudden, just back to back to back to back, all of these amazing moments happen. So football. Undisputed football is phenomenal. But the best thing about football is that, and I think part of why it's such a successful sport is you have the entire week to argue about it. And every single week is a referendum on the previous week. In the same way that baseball is a referendum, every game is a referendum on the previous day. But like that's a little bit too up and down. You can understand losses don't matter that much, wins don't matter that much. In football, these two wins have changed the season for the Seahawks, and it's changed our entire perspective about Mike Macdonald, about John Schneider. At this point, on November 26th, as we're recording this, Mike Macdonald has it figured out with the defense. I actually am leaving this game. It's funny. I was feeling great after the game. I was feeling so good, but I'm weirdly now in this stage of seeing statistically how bullish people are on the Cardinals overall to make the playoffs, how the Seahawks came out of that game and the Cardinals averaged more yards per play. I'm a little bit down, more down on the Seahawks today than I was a week ago before they beat the Cardinals. I don't know if there's a term for this, like survivor's guilt or something like that. Like the As a byproduct of being in first place, because it's one of those moments where I'm like, we're just riding a little too high right now. We're
Right.
riding a little too high on Mike Macdonald. We're riding a little too high on John Schneider. And there's a
We're
lot of
running a little
football
too
left to
high on
play.
blue sky.
I mean, I think Blue Sky's going to be fine, but
I do too. I also think that Mike McDonald was going to be fine.
I honestly don't know. I can't say. Like, Mike Macdonald has had a very good, let's say, 3 weeks in a row, right? I mean, they played the NFC West all in succession, right? Three
That's correct.
consecutive weeks. Mike Macdonald did great against all three of them. His defense did great. Every move that they made has looked perfect so far. But it's kind of one of those things where I'm in this moment and I'm like, I don't want to get to right now we are feeling like this team can make the playoffs and win the NFC West, which I still think is true. I'm not saying that, but it's almost like I don't want to get too high on the Seahawks in this moment because of what we know is coming. I think part of the playoff odds are biased because the Cardinals have, they played two of the worst teams in the league in 2 and 3 weeks consecutively.
Yeah, but it's not as much about the schedule. I mean, that's what I went first looking for. But if you look at it in, you know, say the DVOA projection specifically, like the biggest difference is the Cardinals projected, you know, their weighted DVOA plus preseason expectations, which they call Dave, is that much better than the Seahawks. So if the Seahawks,
that, and they also,
if the Seahawks
they had the
were
game
rated as well, they would have much better chances, maybe even the better chances since they had the tiebreaker.
Well, the most important game that has been played between the two teams so far was on Sunday. The second most important game, now the forthcoming most important game, is in Arizona. They're tied at the moment. Everybody has some winnable games left on schedule. Everybody has some losable games left on schedule. They have the most important game at home now. So it's kind of strange that in this moment, well, I'm so excited about Mike Donald. I think I'm probably one of the few people that came out of the game feeling weirdly good about the offense. I didn't leave.
I mean, I don't know. I guess the offense. You know, the tape folks left it feeling very good about Geno Smith.
Really? Did they?
Oh, you didn't see the post about how it was a near perfect game given the circumstances around him?
I mean, maybe the circumstances around him were that bad. The pick was pretty brutal, though.
Yes, it was a pretty big thing to just say. Well,
if
other
you're
than that,
near perfect, yeah, if you're near perfect involves a red zone interception and like a pretty devastating red zone interception.
Yeah, like look, people are going to throw interceptions. It does seem like the one thing we maybe miss about Pete Carroll is constantly telling people not to turn the ball over. Because let's say Geno is making some decisions this year he did not make the last two seasons.
There's a give and a take with that. I was kind of surprised. I mean, a near perfect game, huh?
The thing on Geno, to just be really quick with it, not everything has to be great or terrible. Most things are just fine. That's the bell curve. That's how it works. Most things are in the middle. Geno is solidly in the middle. And let me tell you, it could be a lot worse than being in the middle. And when we preview the New York Jets, we will be talking about a lot worse than being in the middle. Okay. So we'll get there.
So anyway, that's kind of, as I left that game, I felt great on Sunday, but as it became Monday, as it became Tuesday, I'm kind of like, the season right now is so incomplete and the position that the Seahawks are in is still so tenuous that obviously as you get down the stretch of the football season, every game is going to matter a ton. All of these games are going to matter so much for us judging how the season went. And I think this Jets game coming up, I guess it really feels to me like they beat the Cardinals. It was great. The defense played awesome. I want to keep seeing the defense play awesome. I feel like there's a bit of a thing happening, I guess is what I'll say. That's the thing that's most exciting.
You said it last week. The spirit of the 2010s is back. There was a literal homage to Marshawn Lynch on one of their touchdowns. The 2010s could not be more back.
From the defense, too. Like, there's definitely something to be said about this defense, and the way that they're hyping it up in game, the way that they're playing.
Let's be clear that the offense starting very slowly and doing just enough to win against a team that against in a home game in particular, like that is very 2010 Seahawks as well.
This was a Pete Carroll game that the Seahawks won.
This was every Seahawks Rams game for like 4 or 5 years.
And that's the thing that was kind of crazy about it is the Seahawks Cardinals at home. Thinking about all the different, it's basically they had the one time when they beat the shit out of John Skelton, right?
58-3.
Which was awesome. And that was the moment where like, yeah, we're good. It's like, oh, we're not just good, we're the best team in the league. That game, they lost so many important games to the Cardinals that looked like this game. And so to win this one in the cold, it was pretty gross out. It rained for a chunk of the game. Pete Carroll went out. It's usually later in the season that they lose the home game to the Cardinals, right? Usually they're ruining Christmas Eve or the last game of the season or something like that. I think there was one that they won. I want to say it was the Cardinals, maybe, that they won like a slugfest to get the number one seed 1 year. That might have been the Rams, though.
Wait, slugfest? I'm not sure. There was a game where they blew out the Cardinals in Arizona on the last day of the regular season.
In Arizona, it's been a little bit different sometimes.
They've had because some... they don't have rain there. I don't know if you're aware.
I mean, they also did have a 6-6 tie.
Also, 58-0. Let me not short the Seahawks defense.
Oh, it was 58-0. I was 3. Oh, yeah. I thought it was 3-2.
It was. It's like one of the most lopsided shutouts in NFL history.
So, but I think the way that we've seen JSN emerge, like, and even Ryan Grubb is so close to figuring it out that I actually thought he did some things in this game. It wasn't he did some passing on first down, which I liked that they were willing to do that. They probably went to Ken Walker a little bit more than they should have. But even you look at it overall, in a game
that's one of the things you weren't hearing the broadcast because there was a desire for a lot more running. So much more running. Like those 2 yard runs on first and 10.
I'm sitting next to Chris, who's like, he's like a play action truther or something. So every time they run in the line, Chris is like, play action, play action. And I'm like, I agree with you. But like, I'm like, sometimes they do need to run the ball. But I thought the things that they did getting Ken Walker the ball in space on passes was the way better way of using Ken Walker, right? And kind of his skill set. And some of those plays where he was just an outlet, and Geno actually made some really good plays where the play kind of broke downfield and the Cardinals kind of forgot about Ken Walker and then they got it to Ken Walker in space. Those were awesome. But the screen, obviously, that set up the touch, I guess I was going to say the first touchdown, the touchdown, offensive touchdown to JSN.
It was touchdown.
And then paying it off with the goal line play because you just, it was telegraphed. You're just like, this is a field goal all the way. Oh, you know? You're just like, they're going to get so close and then kick a goddamn field goal. And to get that touchdown also to JSN, he is really becoming a difference maker. And Ryan, I'm telling you, Ryan Grubb is just figuring it out. People aren't giving them enough credit that this shit takes time. He's adjusting to a different style of defense. The Huskies last year had some games where the defense didn't play that well. But for the most part, offensive talent versus defensive talent, they were way better than almost every single team they played last year. So all the shit works. You know, your entire playbook is just like, however you draw it up, when you're way better than the other team, that works. It takes time to adjust to those things. It takes time to figure out a new offense for everybody in the system, for the quarterback, for the receivers, for the running back, and for the offensive coordinator to just get comfortable with it.
It's like you're playing Alabama every week.
Yes.
I mean, I think from a big picture standpoint,
it's like you have to relearn who Mike Vrabel is every single week.
Oh, God. Just every story gets worse. From a big picture standpoint, like even if the Seahawks don't end up being that good this year, even if they don't win, what is it down NFC West? Like if the defense continues playing at a top 10 level, having a defensive coach who actually produces good defenses, like you can figure out the rest of it. Start with check the first box first. So that's why I feel
agree with you and I sort of disagree with you because again, I think we've seen that before. We've seen it where it was Robert Saleh, right? That to me is worst case scenario for something like this. Robert Saleh is a great young defensive coach, had the Jets playing at a really high level early on defensively, and then the bottom fell out. So there are examples of that.
Can I suggest not tying your entire franchise to Aaron Rodgers?
I mean, yes, but even before they did that, things didn't look that... The defense...
Yeah, I mean, look, quarterbacks are very hard to find, and which is why be very careful what you wish for with Geno Smith. But again, if they hired a defensive coach and the defense was bad, that would have been a really bad sign.
No,
that's what
no,
it looked like
totally
for part
agree.
Of the year.
I'm just in full on... Every week, like, let's wait and see mode.
That's fair. Anything else on this game?
I think
awkward silence.
I think it's important to understand what is happening though, a little bit. And I think people around Seattle can feel it. I'm seeing it when I scroll through TikTok or whatever, like being at the stadium. Obviously there were no Cardinals fans there except for some very grumpy Canadians who were next to me. There was a dude next to me who looked just like Brian Doyle Murray in Christmas Vacation.
Wow.
Who had a really gravelly voice. I could not tell what team he was a fan of for a long time until like well into the game. Fortunately, I didn't try to high five him. He was kind of annoying. He was talking to me a little bit too much, but they were somehow Cardinals fans, Canadian Cardinals fans. But what is happening? Like the crowd is getting, we're getting closer, reading closer. Like, the biggest difference from when I started going to games, like having the season tickets, and then into the Pete Carroll era, is the crowd is a radically different crowd than it was in a decade. You know, success does that over time. Losing does that. Both of these things happening at the same time.
The rise of secondary ticket markets.
So all of those things matter, but it's starting to feel a little bit like, I was reminiscing about the last time the Seahawks hosted a home playoff game with fans, right? And it was kind of like, there's something feeling like it's happening here. And I think it's the first time that it's felt like that in, honestly, in the entire Geno Smith era. Even though they made the playoffs with Geno Smith as their quarterback, this is the first time where it's kind of like, there's something that might be bigger. This isn't a, like, they have a chance to limp into the playoffs. They have a chance to eke out some wins. There's a little bit of like, this defense, the skill that they have on it, the energy that they have, what Mike McDonald is doing could be special. And I think that's the thing that can't get lost, is they have to go out and prove it every single week now. But there's a chance that this defense is like, maybe they get to, by the end of the season, it's special. And we might have one of those off seasons where it's like, it's on, like the Lions have had right now, where you just go into the next year and just, you're off, right? You're clearly the best team in the league. So,
well, let's all remain calm on that. But yeah, I mean, the last time the Seahawks hosted a playoff game was against the Detroit Lions and under Jim Caldwell in 2016. And the guy on your sweater, Michael Bennett, was on that team along with Sherm and KJ Wright and Cam Chancellor and Earl Thomas. Was that the season they were injured, Cam and Earl, or were they healthy that season? I can't remember that.
I think this was a game that Marshawn Lynch came back and scored a touchdown in, if I recall correctly.
Like after? What do you mean came back?
Oh, this was before. Because he came back to the Seahawks and scored a touchdown in a playoff game. Maybe that was the Cowboys year that they lost on the road.
It was the year that they lost to the Cardinals at home and then subsequently signed Marshawn Lynch. You'll recall. Okay. Thomas Rawls in the playoff win over the Lions carried 27 times for 161 yards.
Oh,
that's a thing that happened. Cam was held. Oh, that's right. Because Cam, that was the game where...
He had the pick to end it, right?
Yeah. No, that was not that game. He did not have an interception, okay. but he did play in that game. Also, for the record, to close the loop here, I went away from this page. The Giants drafted Tyler Newbin, who has been starting all season for them at safety. So... he seems to be doing just fine.
Cool.
All right.
Good for them.
We got so much more to get to on this pod, including the return of our search for Seattle's best cookie and an unofficial first knockout round of our search for Seattle's best cookie, because you went to two of Seattle's two top cookies and we pitted that. We're able to pit them head to head. So those were Seawolf and Ben's Bread. Quickly, Seawolf, a Seattle bakery, opened in 2014 by brothers Jesse and Kit Schumann, born and raised in Northwest Washington. Following the practices of craftsmanship and local sourcing, Seawolf offers bread and pastry in a space that's comfortable and welcoming to everyone. Seawolf has a modest selection of bread and pastry items, which are prepared by hand and rotate with the seasons. And then from their website, Ben's Bread Company, a family-run Seattle bakery producing small-batch homemade breads and pastries using natural leavening and the finest locally grown ingredients. A portion of all proceeds are donated annually to our local community and other charitable organizations. Their physical location opened in Finney Ridge last year after 8 years as a sourdough bread pop-up.
Wow, okay.
So you went to both of these locations. I've been to Seawolf a couple of times and had never been able to get their trademark brown butter oat chocolate chunk cookie topped with flaky salt. And then also, I am embarrassed to admit that I forget which of the listener brought to our listener meetup, the Discord listener meetup, brought Ben's Bread. And you weren't able to get them at that point since you weren't there, but I had them previously.
So you've had both of these cookies before.
Correct, but not, again, the signature Seawolf cookies. I had, I believe, the double chocolate chip or double chocolate. You're going to want to start talking at any point now because, again, dead air does not really make for great podcasting.
This people just hate dramatic silences.
It does not work in the podcast form. I'm sorry.
Everybody you're hates not, drama.
You're not doing a campaign speech.
It was I honestly, I don't even know what I'm going to pick right now. If we're going to do this, it's unofficial. I'm going into this.
You proposed it.
I know. We have to propose. We have to pick one. Because if one is better than the other, it cannot be. The other cannot be Seattle's best cookie. How about this? If we agree, it's a knockout stage. If we disagree, then we have to find a third party to settle it for us.
That's fair. Yeah.
But also, based upon going to both of them, my experience might be different the next time. So I went first to Seawolf. This was a while ago now, right? Because the whole flicker happened after that. And
you had a flicker of excitement about cookies where you got three different places in a span of 2 days, if I recall correctly.
I'm ready to go get more cookies. Had to get through these. But the going to Seawolf first, having what is it called? Technically?
Their signature is the brown butter oat chocolate chunk cookie topped with flaky salt.
Butter oat chocolate chunk cookie topped with sea salt, right?
Yep.
And so I jotted down, I did a little voice memo to myself after I had both these cookies. And I took the first bite of the brown butter oat chocolate chunk cookie topped with sea salt. And at first I was kind of like, it's huge. It's a large cookie, right?
Correct.
Very big circumference. At first I was kind of like, it's a little crunchier than I would like. It's not the softest cookie on earth. However, when it's a cookie that large, you have both the room to have some crunchy edges and then a very large, soft inside. And I think that's what they ended up doing here, is kind of a byproduct of being such a large cookie. It's going to be a little bit softer if the edges need to be crunchy to have it be cooked at all, right? Because you couldn't have a cookie that size and have it all be soft in the same way. It would fall apart. And I think flavor profile-wise, as I was eating it, I was kind of like, I think this might be the best cookie we've had. Just all of the different flavors, how they shine through, how great some of the inside bites are, right? It is a phenomenal cookie. What was your takeaway on it?
So my notes that I wrote down in Word in my cookie doc, both denser than I expected.
Cookies docx.
Yeah, it is. The double chocolate is almost brownie like in texture.
Yeah, see, I don't like double chocolate. I got that, and I'm personally not judging the double chocolate because this is not a cookie that I like. And cookie places should be judged by their best cookie.
Agreed. When I got just the double chocolate, I brought it to you, but we were not going to review Seawolf that night because we needed to get the real thing. Originally, I wrote, like the flavor, but not enough to make it a real contender, in my opinion. And then I had to strike through in my Word document and then say, upon further review, that is too harsh. This is really, really good.
Wow. What was the further review?
Just I didn't eat the whole thing, right? It all at once. So I went back for more.
Okay. So then I went to Ben's Bread. And I got to go to Yelp to look at Ben's Bread really quick. So what is the signature cookie at Ben's Bread called again?
The salted caramel chocolate chip.
So I got a couple of the salted caramel chocolate chip. I got a corn chip cookie, which I'm pretty high on corn chip cookies in general, corn cookies. I'm pretty solid on them. And this doesn't count toward the ratings, but I did get a donut.
Yeah, how
every
was the donut?
Donut they have. Oh, a blue corn cookie is what it's called. So every donut, as far as I can tell, has basically a donut hole inside of it. I had it late at night one day, and I was just like, okay, this is a great donut. It was some, I can't remember what the fruit was exactly, but a fruit, and then inside of it is a separate donut hole. And as I'm eating it, jumping out of that donut hole is a little bit of cream as well. It's basically a cream puff inside of the donut. It is a goddamn revelation, right? Huh. I'm sad that it wasn't there for when we did our donut search, because I don't know if it would have won the donut search, but it is a real contender for Seattle's best donut. Had a great time eating it. The chocolate chip at first, I was like, flavor profile wise, the softness of it, it's a little bit, if you could draw the archetype of what we're looking for in Seattle's best cookie, this is it. right?
100%.
It's soft, it's gooey all the way through. It's amazing. I think the flavor, and this is almost intentional, right? There's a lot going on in the Seawolf cookie. It is not as complex of a flavor profile. I think the softness that it has going for it is huge, but I think the flavor profile is not quite as much as the Seawolf cookie. And the Seawolf cookie, the way that you could taste all of the different flavors in one really stands out. So my immediate reaction was my preference was for Seawolf overall, despite the fact that it is a chewier cookie than I think we normally like. And then later that night, I just had the blue corn cookie sitting around. And I was like, oh, whatever, I'm just going to try this. I think it was the same time that I had the donut. The blue corn cookie pushed it over the edge for me.
Wow.
It was that good. And also, it was that good like 24 hours later after I had the initial cookie. Because it was close, right? At first, I was like, Ben's Bread and Seawolf, these are both phenomenal. I might have a slight preference for Seawolf. But now when I'm talking the combination of, and I think we're only looking for one cookie, not cookie place.
No, we're looking for cookie place.
Okay. Cookie location. The combination of the two of these is...
Unless we decide to award separately Seattle's best cookie and Seattle's best cookies.
I mean, we might have to do the cookie is Seattle's best cookie.
Yes. I mean...
If you feel like it warrants that after going through this, but...
It'll be interesting to include it with some of these.
But it put the combination of the blue corn cookie plus the chocolate chip, everything that they had going for it. I wish I could say that the donut didn't also help because the donut was phenomenal. But to me, I was like, if I am going to move into one of these bakeries, which is, you know, a lifelong dream of mine is to live at a bakery.
Of course.
Except I do not like waking up early. So I'm going to have to sleep through all the preparation. Wake up, breakfast sandwich right there, cookies, donuts, the whole thing, soft bread. If I had to move into one of these bakeries, I personally am moving to Ben's Bread.
So here was my review. I think the salted caramel chocolate chip might be that one. It's really good on its own as a chocolate chip. And then what I think you're underselling in terms of the taste and the complexity is the crunch and added taste from the caramel on top of the chocolate chip. To me, that puts it on the same corner as the gochujang at St. Bread.
Okay.
In terms of texture and complexity and taste.
The gochujang has a similar thing. It's almost like a creme brulee on top. The caramel, it kind of seems like that.
Exactly. I felt like I remembered liking the corn cookie better when I had them in August than this time. So it didn't really put it over the top. But the end of my conclusion was for Seawolf, this is really, really good, but not quite at the same level as Ben's Bread. I also noted that the listener, Third Pelton Brothers, Zach Jabal, would also dislike the giant chocolate chunks in the Seawolf cookie.
Wow. So that's it.
Ben's Bread.
Ben's Bread. And let me just note for Seawolf. Seawolf is it is a bracket level cookie.
It's right? Without question a 2P cookie.
Yeah. I don't understand the system, but yes, I fully agree with you. I've never agreed with anything more. I think Ben's Bread, on the other hand, just all of those things adding up, it could be Seattle's best cookie. So Ben's Bread might go in as the 1, 2, 3 seed, something like that. I wouldn't be shocked.
Yeah, I mean, I don't look forward to trying to seed all of these. So if we recap for the listener who may have forgotten where we are in this cookie search over the several months of it, the ones that we consider in the bracket right now, Met Market still has the asterisk with the cookie. We have Treat, Chicorina, Bell's, Hello Robin, St. Bread, Cookie Break, Ben's Bread. So that's, I believe, 7 right now. Cookie Break is the home pickup in the neighborhood that is just north of the U District. Ravenna? I believe it's in Ravenna.
I still don't remember this cookie at all.
We met and I gave it to you in the parking lot of my old house.
And then we liked it?
Yeah.
Okay, hell yeah. I mean, that right there, we're getting pretty close. That could be a bracket unto itself, right?
I mean, we have a handful more places that we need to look at. But
how many was that total?
That's seven.
Okay, so we should probably have an eight bracket, right?
And then Met Market is the asterisk. So it could be a full
Is that
bracket if we
seven?
include Met Market. Seven plus Met Market.
Okay.
So.
I mean, I guess basically if we're including Met Market, we would have it would have to be something where it was matched up against something, and you and whomever was picking it both agreed that it was better than the other cookie. That it was matched up against.
Okay. Well, there we go.
So,
Very exciting.
oh yes,
Ben's
very excited.
bread. I don't know how good the bread is, but the cookies are great.
I can tell you, I'm sure the bread is good. I'll let you know. I'm going to be moving in there pretty soon. But
The accommodations? Do they have power?
I mean, when I was there, they did. It was before the bomb cyclone happened. I
I
think
suspect their chances of surviving the bomb cyclone were better than yours.
I might have sensed a flicker.
By the way, we didn't mention shout out to the Seahawks for winning this game without power for 2 days. How many NFL teams can say that?
Yeah, probably none.
Cardinals have no weather, as we've noted. All right, two quick food notes before we get back to sports. This is the last week of Lil Woody's Fast Food Month. It's the Woody's style double burger,
Oh
which
yeah.
I presumably will not be getting because in approximately less than 24 hours, I will actually be having In-N-Out in the LA area. So there you go. Number two, I consumed this in the wild on Saturday night. Rainier Jubilee cans are back for the holiday season.
Oh yeah.
I do not count that as the creep. And a callback to something you haven't heard
All right.
Seattle Mariners, in addition to Haggerty, they non-tendered Josh Rojas, Austin Voth, and JT Chargois, who had previously been designated for assignment earlier in the week. Rojas, undoubtedly the biggest surprise after he started 116 games last season and posted 2B WAR. Voth was worse than replacement. People were making this out to be a money thing. I think it's actually just more, much more a Jerry DePoto is going to find his new set of relievers and they want the roster spot. But
I was
Rojas,
looking to see if JT Chargois was Italian. He's probably French, though, right?
I mean, the name is certainly quite French. Rojas, though, was penciled in possibly as part of a platoon at second or third base. And so this does create another hole for the Mariners to fill, even if it gives them slightly more money for them to go out and sign free agents or trade for players to add to their roster. So.
Yeah, I mean, Josh Rojas had a fine season for Josh Rojas. I do not know if I would say that it gives them another. I mean, like the two wins is kind of shockingly high, but I don't know if I say that if I would say that this means that they have to fill another spot, because if Josh Rojas is starting at that spot, you still need to fill that spot. Literally, there will be a body at third base, at second base, somebody. And if that body is Josh Rojas, you're not mission accomplished
But I
in
don't
that
think it's
scenario.
like, oh, they're just gonna bring in, make Ryan Bliss the starter at second base, and now they've done better than Josh Rojas. Like, that's not how it works. So they need to bring in somebody better, I think. We'll see.
I don't know. How about that? I'm willing to say that if it's Ryan Bliss and it's Josh Rojas, there's a good chance that it's probably apples to apples. But also, if Ryan Bliss is your starting second baseman, you still have a hole to fill at second base. Like,
Correct.
just there being a player there, or being a there being a player who is as good as Josh Rojas there, doesn't mean that it's done. And I think that's been one of the problems that the Mariners have had, that they went into the last offseason and they were I understand they should have re it was reasonable to expect more Mitch Garver, maybe a little bit more from Mitch Haniger, whatever. Like, there are some positions that they could have reasonably expected more from. Josh Rojas at third base, when they were like, that's it, that's what we're doing, that was not a good way to approach the season.
I mean, I think it was fine. Again, I think those other things were bigger issues.
If Josh Rojas is fine at third base, everything else has to be that much better.
I suppose. So it's possible that one piece of the puzzle is left-handed first baseman, third baseman Austin Shenton, who they acquired Tuesday after he was designated for assignment by Tampa Bay. Shenton is a Bellingham native who played a year at Bellevue College after initially signing with UW, then was drafted by the Mariners in the fifth round in 2019 out of Florida International. They sent him to Tampa Bay in 2021 as part of their trade for Diego Castillo, which also sent JT Chargois to the Rays. So ironic that Chargois ends up getting pushed off the roster to make room for Shenton. Now, Shenton made his MLB debut in March and played 19 total games for the Rays. He'll turn 27 in January. He had a big 2023 at AAA Durham, hitting 301 with an OPS greater than 1,000, but that dropped to 258 batting average at AAA last season with 20 homers in 83 games. And I think realistically, though, he's kind of this year's Jason Vossler.
Yeah.
So, someone who...
He's somebody who he'll start playing in, like, July, and I'll be like, who the fuck is this guy?
Yes, and I'll point out that we talked about him.
Yes.
It'll be like the second section. I look forward
to it. Although, I said the same thing about Victor Robles, right? Where I was like, Victor Robles will be a footnote in history. And then all of a sudden, Victor Robles is, I'm like, center field's done. We're good. Not center field.
Hopefully, right
field. The outfield. Yeah, the outfield is locked in. So you never know.
And you may recall Shenton just because he's local. He's got the local ties.
Oh, I may, but don't count on it.
The Mariners also announced they are hiring Kevin Seitzer as their hitting coach, with Edgar Martinez remaining on the staff as senior director of hitting strategy. Seitzer spent the last 10 seasons as the Braves hitting coach and has served in that role for the Blue Jays, Diamondbacks, and the Royals, his primary team during his playing career. They also added Eric Young Jr. as first base coach as part of a reshuffling of duties and a way for us to remember some guys.
I loved it. Kevin Seitzer.
What a guy.
Definitely a guy. Yeah, I was trying to remember what team he played for, but he's very Royals, right?
Yes, he debuted for them, and I don't know exactly how many years he played, but a lot.
So he's been the Braves hitting coach for 10 years?
Yes.
I mean, obviously has worked with some pretty phenomenal talents during that time period.
Then they had a really down hitting season, and so much like the Mariners hitting coaches took the fall for it, so did Kevin Seitzer in Atlanta.
He was being let go of by the Braves. He'd already been let go of. Yes. I mean, it's one of those things like, yeah, the Braves hitting. It's not like Kevin Seitzer forgot how to coach hitting in that time period. All of the players that he coached along the way, Freddie Freeman's, people like that, right? Their down hitting season may have come because their best player was out for the year before the season started.
Did you know that Kevin Seitzer was an All-Star in 1995?
I am not surprised by that information. A lot of random guys were
a solid 2B war that season. He had as many as 5.5. Oh, he was an All-Star in 87 with the Royals when he had 5.5 war. So two-time All-Star, Kevin Seitzer.
There you go.
Wow. We surely watched the 1995 All-Star game. I did not remember that Kevin Seitzer was a part of it. All right, Seattle Kraken, since we've last discussed them.
I have to say before that, notably was not able to fix Jared Kelenic.
Wow. Yes, true. Since we've last discussed them, the Kraken went 4-2, finishing their six-game homestand at 5-1, and then splitting a pair of games last weekend in the LA area. They host Anaheim on Thanksgiving Eve before a home-and-home against the lowly San Jose Sharks. It's a chance for them to pick up points as they're currently outside the West playoff picture in 10th, but just a point back of a tie for 7th, and they rank 5th in goal differential in the Western Conference. Bad news for the Kraken, Captain Jordan Eberle underwent surgery for a pelvic injury last Friday, is expected to miss at least 3 months. The good news is defenseman Vince Dunn on his way back, expected to play as soon as next week, having last played October 17th. Seattle Sounders. We mentioned this at the top. After a scoreless first half, they saw LAFC take the lead in the 50th minute through Ryan Hollingshead. It took the Sounders less than 10 minutes to equalize, utilizing an own goal that they created with some action in the LAFC box. The game then went to extra time, where Jordan Morris gave the Sounders the lead in the 109th minute, and they saw out their first victory over LAFC since May 2021. LAFC tried 26 shots in this game, 10 of them on target, had 2 XG to 1 for the Sounders, but Stefan Fried made 9 saves, several of the highlight variety, to preserve the win.
Awesome. Did you watch any of this?
I followed along with some of it, but the only part I actually watched was basically right after the Jordan Morris goal. Like, I turned it on and they were showing the replay of the Jordan Morris goal, and I saw the rest of extra time.
Do you have the Apple TV MLS package or whatever?
I do, yes.
Really?
Yeah.
When did you get that? You've had that all year?
I have had it all year. Look, that is my commitment to the roundup.
I thought you were going to say to the Sounders. Nope, commitment to the roundup.
I assume this weekend's game is actually on TV. One would think for the Western Conference Finals.
I would really hope so, because I intended on watching this game. Power was back. You know, I was like, I've lived through the flicker. And I was so excited to watch it. And then to find that it was on the solely the Apple TV MLS package or whatever.
I guess bad news. It is not on TV either. I mean, I guess the real issue is they're playing these games on Saturday night.
I've got some notes. Like, MLS, if the goal is to become a much larger, have a larger impact throughout American sports, maybe give people the chance to watch the fucking games. Like, it is a huge factor as far as the awareness around the team overall, just being on local television. It is massive. I get it. You're trying to gatekeep it. You're trying to make extra money. It is the wrong approach.
By the way, the overall numbers on the Kraken's TV viewership being on Kong versus being on Root, it is like wild. They have tripled their viewership this year.
Have they really? I'm telling you, it has
a good story on that.
Easy for people.
You have Blazers, on the other hand, can't watch them on HD in Seattle.
Oh my God, it's hilarious to watch. It is actually like going into a time machine to watch the Blazers broadcast. It's actually unwatchable.
I bought their streaming service just so I can watch their games in HD, but I like it.
They don't
it doesn't
play
really
in Seattle. It's different. It doesn't matter if you can't watch the Blazers.
I agree.
In
Seattle. Yes, I'm just noted.
That shit matters, though. It matters for impact to society. The Jake Paul Mike Tyson fight, if that is a pay per view fight, no one cares. Like, people care, but like,
it's not the same.
It does not. It being on Netflix, which almost everybody has, it made it a fucking moment, right? Like, that it was everywhere because of the accessibility. I understand you have to profit off things at some point, but the way that the MLS has approached this as a small, still a small league, right? They're a distant fifth, if they're even a fifth right now. Like, if you want to rank professional sports, like, you're after college
football.
All
right, we're an hour into the podcast. We don't need to do the rankings of where MLS is.
It's really difficult. And if there's another playoff game happening that is not, and just like, I'm good, y'all, I'm good. So maybe if they play in the championship, it'll be on TV. I might even go if they play in the championship, if they win this match and it's in Seattle. Because I think it was almost guaranteed. I was hearing that the Eastern Conference team.
Yes, the winner of the Western Conference final will host MLS Cup.
So I might go to the match, but this idea of not being able to watch these important matches is fucking brutal.
I hypothetically, I'm going to be in LA on Saturday night when this game is played there. We'll not be attending the match, alas, at 7 p.m. Saturday night at 7 p.m. against LA Galaxy, who beat Minnesota United 6-2 to prevent a rematch of the 2020 conference final, tying an MLS Cup playoff record for goals. The Galaxy were the number 2 seed in the West, top team remaining in terms of regular season record. That's a huge turnaround from last season when the Galaxy finished 13th. In the Western Conference. Newcomer Gabriel Peck had a team high 16 goals and 14 assists in the regular season, to go with 15 goals from Dejan Jovalich and a team high 16 assists from Riqui Puig, both holdovers. Galaxy third in MLS in goals, led the league in expected goals, but their expected goal differential, according to American Soccer Analysis, ranked just ninth behind the Sounders in sixth. So not a strong defense for the Galaxy. Their last trip to the Western Conference Finals was in 2014 when they beat the Sounders during the last of their 5 MLS Cup runs. Both of the regular season meetings between the two teams came early in the season, with the Galaxy winning 1-0 at home in March and scoreless draw in Seattle in May. But the Sounders beat the Galaxy 3-1 during the League's Cup knockout stages at home.
Hello. This one feels like there's definitely a chance here.
Oh, I mean, I don't think they... Like, you know, the Galaxy were right there with LAFC for the number one seed all season. But again, goal differential wise, Sounders were in the same ballpark. They're not going to be intimidated by playing on the road. I think the Galaxy are the favorites, but I think this is closer to like 40 to 45% chances of the Sounders to win this one.
All right.
You're going to offer your percentage chances of victory? You did last week.
I'm going to watch the stills on SportsCenter after.
Oh, God. You know, women's basketball. They almost did it.
Oh,
they lit nearly
the
other way.
Hang the almost banner.
But couldn't complete their stunning upset of number 7 LSU, falling 68-67 Monday in the Bahamas on a Kalen Gilbert layup in the final 2 seconds. They did have a chance to win it at the buzzer, but turned it over after advancing the ball. The Huskies held the Tigers to 39% shooting on twos and also saw LSU shoot 3 of 17 on threes. Anissa Morrow had 19 points and 13 boards, but shot 5 of 17 from the field. And Michaela Williams was 0 for 9. Huskies got 24 points and 9 boards from Delia Daniels in a game where all the starters, where the starters scored all 67 points, I should say, no bench points in this one for the Huskies. So, like, a bummer that they couldn't pull off this, what probably would have been, I don't know. I mean, they beat Stanford a couple of years ago, but it would have been one of the biggest wins of the Tina Langley era without question. And it's, but it is an excellent sign that they're going to be competitive as they head into Big Ten play for the first time.
Absolutely. Yeah. The, I mean, not winning for this Husky team is actually not that big of a deal overall, because what we're looking for, it would be nice to have a signature win when they're going into the NCAA tournament. I have no idea if that's even necessarily a thing that's in the window. It's probably an outside chance right now. So a signature win would have been nice. It's more about judging whether this team is going to be competitive. So,
I mean, they're 40th right now in the Bart Torvik rankings, which feels a little more appropriate than when they were up in the 20s. But, you know, that's going to put you solidly on the bubble and a position where a win like this could have made the difference.
But it does feel like if you're this close in this game, there'll be chances in the Big Ten to have big wins. And if they win those,
there'll be chances soon. We should talk about, so the Huskies are 6-2. We may have alluded to this last week, but they lost at Montana in a game where they shot just 2 of 14 from 3. Okay.
You forget that we did a podcast last week?
I forget how abbreviated it was, I guess.
You did a lot of rundown.
The U-Double wrap up the Pink Flamingo Championship by facing Southern Wednesday morning before taking a week and a half off to prepare for their first Big Ten game against a new fun foe, UCLA.
Oh, wow. Big Ten basketball.
UCLA took down number one South Carolina on Sunday, so that's going to be a big one.
You know who else lost to Montana?
The 2021 UW football team. Yeah.
Honestly, things looked way up after that.
Yes, if it turns out long term, if they're in the national championship game in 2 years, sign me up. I don't know who the women's basketball equivalent of Kellen DeBoer is. They would replace Gino, I guess. All right, UW men's basketball. Coming off a 74-69 win against UMass Lowell, which we may or may not have talked about, beat Alcorn State 77-60 on Friday.
Oh, God, that one. Oof.
Like, it was tied at 47 with 14 minutes left before the Huskies outscored Alcorn State 30-13 the rest of the way. It was a monster game for Tyler Harris with a career-high 27 points on 8 of 11 shooting, including 3 of 5 from 3 and 8 rebounds. Freshman Zoom Diallo made his first start, scored 15 points, and Alcorn State really locked down in Great Osabor, who attempted just 4 shots, scoring 8 points in this one.
I'm starting to think he's not so great Osabor right now, because the returns have not been amazing so far. And unfortunately, we're in this era where we're kind of more aware of the NIL money that players are making. And it's been a little surprising that he hasn't been one of the dominant impact players. We'll see once they get to actual Big Ten play. But
I'd also have to watch like an actual game to know
see
how much other teams are just like sinking onto him because of the fact that UW can't shoot. I don't think it's unrelated to Tyler Harris player making 3 threes.
I think he would have that impact almost no matter what.
I mean, is having a lot of impact in many of these games with his rebounding and in his distribution. It's just the scoring has not always been there.
Just seeing how close it was against Alcorn State is, we're talking about signs of things.
You can change the coach as many times as you want. You can change the conference. UW playing close games against bad non-conference teams is a tradition that will never go away.
I think I pulled up Rutgers was, I don't know if you saw this one. Rutgers maybe lost to somebody pretty bad.
They lost it at Kennesaw State.
Yes, yeah, losing at Kennesaw.
A true road game. Like, give them credit.
I guess credit. Here we are. There's your credit to go and lose to Kennesaw. But I was like, what conference are we in? And this must happen across the board. Obviously, every conference has bad non-conference losses, but it felt a little bit Pac-12-y.
Yes, especially with multiple one-and-done prospects. That does check out.
See, a ranked Rutgers, right, lose at Kennesaw. I was like, oh, God.
Up next for the Huskies, the Acrisure Invitational this week on Thanksgiving Day. They'll play Colorado State at 3:30 p.m. This one will be on TV, on True TV. Check it out months before the NCAA tournament. Just give prep yourself for the NCAA tournament. Channel 705.
Early today, 705. Okay. Earlier today, I was like, who's ready to watch UW Colorado State on Thanksgiving on True TV, baby?
Right during dinner time. Despite retaining Nico Medved after last year's NCAA tournament appearance, their second in 3 years after a 9-season drought, Colorado State off to a slow start. They needed OT to beat Tennessee State at home, lost by 15 to Ole Miss, and then lost at home in OT to UC Riverside. They lost four senior starters from last year's team that beat the Huskies 86-81 in Las Vegas, returning only fifth-year senior Neek Clifford, who started his career at Colorado, most notably Isaiah Stevens, who was kind of a fringe draft prospect. Was one of those guys that graduated. So it's definitely not the same Colorado State team. So the Huskies are favored. They should win this one. The winner will face the winner of Santa Clara and TCU on Friday. The Horned Frogs, the top-ranked team in the Acrisure Invitational, with the Broncos off to a 2-4 start.
Oof, okay. What time is that game on Sunday?
That'd be Friday. Did I say Sunday?
On Friday. Yeah, no, you said Friday.
TBD, because it depends whether they win or lose. I don't know off the top of my head what time the two are scheduled. Well, UW football, they're playing Oregon. It'll be the last week of the season. This is a thing now. This came up on my Hoop Collective appearance that'll be out on Wednesday. The discussion of the fact that it was not the Apple Cup at the end of the season.
Wow.
And that got into
hot takes and football talk.
That got into Tim McMahon being surprised that there were so many different types of apples, because they were asking me which types of apples are synonymous with, or like are familiar with, Washington. So I had to shout out the Cosmic Crisp.
Okay.
Although I feel like the most Washington apple is still probably the Red Delicious.
Oh, it's a garbage apple though.
I agree, but like when you think of Washington apples, that's what you think of, right?
I guess so. I mean, it just looks like an apple.
Exactly. The Apple Cup logo is red.
But we're not playing the Apple Cup. We're playing the granddaddy of the ball. And
is that what they're calling it these days? I was thinking that we need a nickname for the UW Oregon game.
Yeah, we really don't have a name for this rivalry. But
Cascadia Cup is sadly already taken.
I mean, I like having this one at the end of the year. It definitely gives the game it feels like Michigan, Ohio State, something like that. It gives it the pomp and circumstance that this game deserves, rather than, it's been throughout the schedule, all sorts of different places, and it's something that you have circled, but there's kind of nothing like having the game after Thanksgiving is after. They played so many important games these last couple of years. Again, most of them taking place right in the middle of the season, obviously the conference championship game last year, but
look, this is UW's biggest rival. Like, we don't have to like talk around it.
There's not even a question about that. Yeah. It's UW's biggest rival, but it's also becoming nationally, it's not on the same scale, like I said, of Michigan, Ohio State or something like that, but it is becoming a bigger rivalry nationally also. It's becoming recognized as, I think when people think of it, they're thinking of these two teams together. Obviously, moving to the Big Ten is part of it. The first year in the Big Ten has gone a little bit different for each of these programs. So obviously
they were Oregon, set up in different positions.
Yes. Oregon being the number one team in the country. Their coach, both of the coaches probably had a chance to be the head coach of Alabama that coached the two teams from the Northwest last year. And one of them stayed, a lot of the roster stayed. One of them is in a transition year. I think UW has had a very good year for the transition year. This is the most important game of the season. Beating Michigan was huge. Going at Penn State was fun. The bowl game will be nice. This is it. This is the game. And seeing, like the quotes from throughout the country, like this is the game that matters overall. And where people like, it doesn't matter for Oregon necessarily. There's some seeding stuff for the playoff. This game still matters for everybody involved. It might not knock them out of the playoff, but it is a huge game for all parties involved. And it's a huge game because it is almost certainly going to be Damon Williams' first start as UW quarterback. And obviously, huge magnitude for that situation, for something like that to happen. This could be the beginning of something very big for Damon Williams and for this UW program overall. A win here could be, it's a season-defining victory for Jed Fish. It is a total transformation. We talked about Mike McDonald, the way that you think the difference a couple of weeks can make. John Schneider, Mike McDonald. this could completely transform how we think about Jedfish overall, in the way that two seasons ago, Kalen DeBoer was a nice coach. We were happy with the return so far. He went to Oregon and it was fucking on, right? Yep. The win at Oregon was, oh shit, this team is a team all of a sudden. So do I think it's likely to happen? Not necessarily, but do I feel like there is a chance that they could have a season-defining victory at Oregon this year? Obviously, I think there's a chance going into it.
According to Wikipedia, this is known as the Cascade Clash or the Border War, which Border War, A, besides just generally moving away from wars in sporting game nicknames.
Both cities are just so far from the border that it's kind of like...
But it
like
also already
all rivals
exists.
Border each other.
Isn't Border War is, yeah, it's Kansas, Missouri is the Border War. Like, come on. And Cascade Clash, we can do better than that. Let's keep workshopping this one.
Yeah, we'll figure it out.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a chance for UW to be competitive in this game because the advanced stats don't quite match Oregon's undefeated record or number one ranking. They're sixth
absolutely
in FPI
not
efficiency. They actually rated far better last season when they were second in FPI efficiency. And there's a couple of reasons for that. Number one, their strength of schedule ranks 52nd. Like, they've only played two teams that were ranked at the time all season, although Boise State obviously has proven much better.
Oh,
than
they weren't ranked when they played them.
They were
them.
Not ranked at that time. Now
who was
they
the
are
other ranked team?
In the CFP. Illinois.
Fucking Illinois.
But
okay. Yeah, like Michigan, Ohio State doesn't have a name. You don't need a name.
Fair. You look at last year's game, the difference between last year's Oregon team and this year's Oregon team, and the difference is they're 3-0 in games decided by 3 points or fewer this year. Last season, they were 0-2. Both of those games were played against the same opponent. It was UW. They won both of those games. It was great. Big fan. So, like, this is how you go undefeated. You're a very good team, and you get a little lucky, as the Huskies did, frankly, last year in going undefeated through the regular season in the conference championship.
But I think the other difference is still quarterback play.
I mean, yes. So their offense last year was much stronger. They're fourth in FPI efficiency this year, but still, like, you know, in terms of the absolute ranking, they were much higher last year than they are this year.
It was a much better and a much scarier offense overall. They're without Tez Johnson, who I'm assuming is not playing in this game. Or
I didn't check it for an update today, but Tez Johnson posted he's back over a picture of himself on Instagram last week after missing the last two games with a shoulder injury suffered in their win at Michigan.
Okay, well, that's not great. And definitely was a factor in their near loss at Wisconsin. So we'll see about that one. They've definitely also, I think the defense maybe is also not as strong as they were a year ago statistically.
No, the defense is better statistically.
Are they really? So the offense was just that good last year.
Yeah. I mean, Bo Nix almost won the Heisman.
Bo Nix had an awesome season, and Dylan Gabriel had a very high degree to live up to in Bo Nix. But Dylan Gabriel is not Bo Nix. And that offense that they ran, it was frustrating to watch because of how efficient they were. It was a lot of running the ball, quick passes, beat you deep. And it's still a little bit of what they do. Dylan Gabriel is a little bit more of an over-the-middle throwing quarterback. He still scrambles kind of like Bo Nix does. This is going to be a massive test for UW's defense overall. But we'll walk us through Oregon offensively.
Yeah, I mean, the thing about Gabriel is his stats look very similar in many regards to what Bo Nix did last season. He's been organized, I think, to a degree. Can we use that as a term?
He was awesome at Oklahoma as well. It's not
But I'm saying his stats were somewhat different there, is what I'm telling you.
Yeah.
So he's fifth in QBR. He's down one spot from last season when Nix was second. His completion percentage is up to a career high 74%. Nix was at 78%, but his yards per completion are down in this, you know, much more quick passing error. It's not an air raid offense, but the Oregon offense is much more quick passing. Big time goal line threat with six touchdowns. He's tops among Big Ten QBs in rushing EPA, according to QBR. So again, that similarity carries over. The other guy that they're missing is Troy Franklin, that you haven't talked about, that was a huge part of their success last year. And, you know, as an NFL receiver, who's now still catching
Bucky
passes
Irving as well. You know, like, they're missing a lot of threats on offense.
I'm not as worried about
Johnson,
Bucky Irving,
like players like that.
Their running game is fine. Jordan James, has over 1,000 yards. He leads all Big Ten rushers in EPA. They're just fine there, although backup Noah Whittington has not been nearly as effective. So maybe their depth is down a little bit running back. Despite missing the last 2 weeks, Tez Johnson still has 17 more catches than any other Duck, team high 8 touchdowns, although Texas A&M transfer Evan Stewart has nearly as many receiving yards thanks to more yards per reception. And the guy who kind of scares me is tight end Terrence Ferguson, a threat up the seam who had 2 touchdowns in last year's Pac-12 championship game.
Oh, yeah. Terrifying.
Also, you never know when an injury could strike and he could have to leave the field and stop the clock. It's, you know, it's a constant fear with Terrence Ferguson.
I hate this team so fucking much. Ugh, God.
They are just 5th in opponent EPA per play among Big Ten teams, although they are 12th in FPI efficiency defensively, so they've faced a harder, I think, slate of offenses than they have defenses to a degree. They are 3rd best in terms of EPA against the Pac. I mean, they played Boise State. Like,
yes. No, they played Boise State. They played Ohio State. They played Idaho.
That does not factor in, alas. 3rd best, although it does factor into EPA, I guess. 3rd best against the pass, just behind UW in the Big Ten rankings, but similarly weak to the Huskies against the run. They gave up 200-plus rushing yards to both Boise, with Ashton Genty going for 192, and Purdue, but have benefited from forcing teams to pass by building leads. Opponents have passed, have run far more frequently against UW than they have against Oregon. Remarkably, Iowa State, the only team this season to throw for more than 206 yards against the Ducks. So, you know, all those same factors that I thought pointed to, all right, let's keep Will Rogers as the starter against UCLA. All those factors have flipped very much to Damon Williams has to be a huge threat running the ball for the Huskies to have any chance in this game.
Yep.
Sophomore Mateo Uyangalale, the younger brother of DJ, has broken out with 8.5 sacks. He ranks 2nd in the Big Ten in that regard. So he's someone to watch for sure. Do you have anything else on Oregon?
I feel like this game, you know, we've talked about Damon Williams. If he had played a full season, if he was eligible, probably 3rd in the Pac-12 in QBR, or the Pac-12, 3rd in the Big Ten in QBR is where he would rank if he was eligible to qualify.
Yeah, I'd have to double check that ranking hasn't changed after last week.
Obviously, Oregon is aware of that information. It's something we want them to game plan for Damon Williams, right? We want them to be thinking about Damon Williams in this way. I love the run game where basically by Damon being there at quarterback, I'd be actually curious to see Jonah Coleman's yards per carry, Will Rogers versus Damon Williams. And maybe it's just kind of like he's faced such more difficult opponents, Jonah, when Damon has been or they're able to lock in on the run. But I like Jonah running the ball more with Damon on the field. I
so
love
for
the
record,
idea of,
it has changed.
He's even higher.
He would be number 1 in QBR.
Hello! There it is! Hang the banner!
I mean,
number
maybe,
1 in QBR.
Maybe
that's
the one
he's ahead of. He moved ahead of Dylan Gabriel, who didn't even play? Or was he always ahead of? He was behind Curtis Rourke and Will Howard?
Yes, that is correct.
Wow!
Maybe the QBR that's on his page is not opponent adjusted the way that the one on the rankings is. I can't say that for certain.
They were spent so much time hyping up this Ohio State-Indiana game, right? This potent Indiana offense. Ohio State is dominant. They failed to recognize that the best quarterback in the Big Ten plays in Seattle.
Triple size is real, kids.
I love everything about that. But honestly, Damon, he does it all right now. So I'm excited about the prospects of, you look at Wisconsin, right? They probably didn't run the ball enough in that game. Brayden Locke was 12 for 28 for 96 fucking yards. But Tawi Walker, 20 carries for 97. Pretty solid output. This may be the type of game that we kind of thought this UW team never really materialized in this way. This season, they passed the ball more than I think we thought they were going to. And it's, of course, because defenses were forcing them to. This might be the game that UW really runs the ball, which also means all the negatives have to go away, right? And I think it has to be, they have to play a basically near perfect game with regards to blocks in the backs, holds, things like that, face masks, things that they've been called for too many times, legal hands in the face. It's one of those games that we just don't want the big play, and then all of a sudden you see the flag, right? I think that is going to be huge in this game. And for UW with Damon Williams, they're going to be coming out with the perspective of, we are going to run the ball a lot. They're aware of Oregon's tendencies. They're aware that Damon Williams is not a pocket passer in the same way that Will Rogers is. It's going to be running, doing a bunch of short passing, and hitting Denzel Boston those ways. So creativity, I think, getting everybody into space, getting the receivers into space, getting Damon into space, plus Jonah Coleman. And this is an Oregon team that you can do that against. So I think the big takeaway is they just need to be in a position that they're within a score. This is what Boise State did, right? Boise State was within a score. They kept it very, very close the entire game. They ended up not winning. This is what Wisconsin did to Oregon a week ago. They got key stops. You know, Dylan Gabriel threw some pretty brutal picks along the way. But if you can tackle and keep everything in front of you, if they can Mike McDonald up this game and not have those blown plays, that's what we just can't have, is all of a sudden there's, you know, Tez Johnson going for 80 yards, something like that. You know, those types of plays, you know, Jordan James breaks one. If they can avoid those things, make Oregon work, make them churn, just play after play after play after play, if they can slow the game down and, you know, maintain the ball, that's the kind of game that they have to play to beat Oregon. This is not, they're not going to win a shootout against Oregon, right? They are going to win a game where they control the ball, where they are opportunistic a little bit, they avoid negatives. I think there is a chance in this game. I'm not saying it's likely, but I think Damon Williams, with he's had a couple of weeks, it's a beautiful situation to install him as starting quarterback, right?
The beautiful situation is going on the road against your biggest enemy when they're undefeated and ranked number one in the country.
Having two, they're not that great of a defense. They're a worse defense than Penn State statistically, right?
I think so.
I mean, Damon, like, what is the other situation? He got thrown into it in the fucking whiteout against Penn State. So it's not like Damon Williams, even though he's a freshman.
I mean, the two games, yes, he's played the most have been Penn State, who's number 9 in FPI efficiency on defense, Iowa, who's 11th, Oregon is 12th.
So, and what Damon was able to do against Penn State was pretty solid. I would take it. Still an 80 QBR. Like, can he keep those chains moving, Damon, in this game? I'm so excited. Like, I feel like it's win this by 42 points or the Huskies somehow eke it out.
Well, I think it's kind of like the Iowa game in that regard, right? Where there's sort of these alternate paths you could go on, and like, or maybe the Indiana game, I guess, is the better comparison, where like,
if the Huskies one of the paths isn't a pick six if, early on.
If the Huskies had been able to take the lead on Indiana, then it could have been a totally different game. But they didn't take the lead on Indiana, and therefore it didn't end up all that competitive in the end. And, you know, I think Oregon is better than Indiana without question. But, you know, that's sort of the thing, where can they come up with a turnover early in the game that helps them take the lead and changes kind of the game script for both
teams? Or just
the
drive. Like, the first drive they had against Penn State, it was solid until it wasn't, right?
But, yeah, the solid until it wasn't isn't going to cut it here. It's got to be close to perfect, as you were saying.
The thing that I don't believe about Oregon in the same way that I do about going at Penn State is, first off, a lot of these players on the team have already beaten this team twice. So that is, it matters.
Well,
you know,
a lot of the players on this team have already beaten them three times.
Or yes. I mean, yes. A lot of the players on the team have beaten them multiple times. So going at Oregon is not that I'm not saying that they were intimidated at Penn State or whatever. It was a brand new experience for basically everybody involved. The physicality of the blue blood Big Ten teams is still higher. It is still higher at, and that's why Oregon had a hard time at Wisconsin. You know, those games, when you're going to those teams, it is a different experience. I do not believe that it's the same. I don't think Oregon can line up and run the ball 60 times against the Huskies and win the game. They have to kind of do their Oregon thing. And if it means that it takes longer drives to get down the field, like, I believe in Carson Bruner. I believe in the secondary to do some things. I don't think Dylan Gabriel is that great of a quarterback overall. So I don't think they're likely to win. I can see the path, though. The path is they make a couple of plays, they get some key stops, maybe there's a fourth down stop. Damon Williams has himself a game. He runs the ball, they just unleash it. You know, if you get Damon unleashed, it's like, go. And then when you're thinking about that as a defender, when you have to account for Damon Williams, that means that Jonah Coleman is getting that much more space. As long as he doesn't make mistakes passing the ball, and as long as they don't have the holds and things like that, that I think would be the big negative, having those types of plays, because I'm not sure that they can pick up second and 20s, something like that, against Oregon. But I'm feeling weirdly confident about this game.
I'm of two minds. I mean, I definitely like can see the scenario where they're right in it until the end. Still probably don't see them winning, but I can also see the scenario where this gets, like the Penn State game, gets out of hand.
Oh, I mean, basically every road game all season has gotten out of hand.
Yeah.
So.
Percentage chances of victory?
I'm going to say it is a 20% chance of victory.
I'm going to say 10%. FPI says 11.
I can't wait. This is it. This is the season. They've done great at home. This is DeMond Williams' chance. I think we will find out on Saturday night exactly what DeMond Williams is right now. Maybe not long term, but we will find out what DeMond Williams is right now. And if he can have a huge game, make some big plays, go in, possibly upset Oregon, because they're an upsettable team. That is the one thing I've watched as a hater. Again, I analyzed each row all season. I've analyzed Oregon every chance I've had. I have watched Oregon as much as possible, purely from a hatred standpoint. And I'm telling you, this team is beatable. That is everything that I've taken away from it. They are a beatable team. They've had some good wins. I hope that there's no fuckery from Dan Lanning. There will be.
Of course.
I'm confident of it. Hope the Huskies are able to avoid the fuckery and overcome it. And they are not. I didn't think Penn State was a beatable team. I thought there was no chance. I mean, I put percentage chance of victory, I think 7% for that one. I was like, I've seen this team. They're not beatable. This is a winnable game.
I also think they're upsettable, but I don't want to say that this is where we find out about DeMond Williams Jr. To me,
this is
we've
we
already
find out where he is right now.
No, I don't want to put that. I want to say that, look, DeMond Williams Jr. has had an awesome season. He is largely responsible for helping UW get bowl eligible with the win over UCLA. The season is, if not a success, at least, you know, a pass because of the fact that they got bowl eligible. And whatever happens on Saturday night, positive for the Huskies, it's all gravy. That's
all
how
right.
I'm viewing it.
I can't freaking wait. I can't wait. This, honestly, the last time we played Oregon, I wasn't even excited about it. It was all stress. This one I'm just excited about because we lose, whatever.
Yeah.
That one was like, the stakes were so freaking high. So this, and for, I wish the stakes were a little bit higher for Oregon. So they'd play probably just that much tighter, but they're still high.
Well, you know who the stakes aren't high for? The New York Jets. Quickly, a little Seahawks news. Uchenna Nwosu's practice window has opened. Mike McDonald has indicated, doesn't sound like he's going to play this weekend, but hopefully he can be back to face the Cardinals in Arizona the week after that.
I mean, that's freaking huge with the way the defensive line is playing right now. If you drop an Uchenna Nwosu in there, hello. Hello.
The Jets are 23rd in DVOA. They started 2-3, costing Robert Saleh his job in favor of defensive coordinator Jeff Ulbrich in an interim role. They then added Devontae Adams when they were at 2-4 and have subsequently lost 4 of their next 5, including a home loss to Indy prior to the bye week when Anthony Richardson scored the go-ahead touchdown in the final minute. That cost GM Joe Douglas his job during the bye week and has basically eliminated the Jets from playoff contention at this point.
Nobody should lose to the Colts. I don't know how they're 5-6, but nobody should lose to that team.
Coming off an Achilles rupture, Rodgers, averaging a career-low 6.4 yards per attempt, good for 29th out of 36 qualifying quarterbacks. He's 24th in EPA plus CPOE composite, 30th in CPOE. He's also 24th in QBR. The addition of Adams hasn't worked at all. He's caught just 56% of his targets for 6 yards per target, worse than his stats with the Raiders last past 2 seasons, and worse than Mike Williams, who was traded to Pittsburgh after the Adams trade. Garrett Wilson does have 69 catches, but it's almost entirely because of his massive target volume. He's averaging just 6.7 yards per target. And Alan Lazard had been the Rodgers friend who actually contributed with 9.4 yards per target before going on IR with a chest injury. The run game has been pretty average. Like, people drafted Breece Hall so high.
Oh my God.
In fantasy leagues
this
year.
Number one. Yeah.
Well, might have worked out better than Christian McCaffrey has worked out thus far this season, I will say.
Oh, we love to see it.
There's still time. Jordan Mason was good.
There's still time?
Yeah.
Sure.
I mean,
there is.
Still in contention in Dalton Cast Champions League. There's still plenty of time. Defense has not been as strong as last year when, despite the Rodgers injury and, you know, makeshift quarterback play much of the season, the Jets at least managed to go a more competitive 7-10. They are 18th in EPA per play and 25th against the run. So maybe this is a chance for the Seahawks run game to finally get going, much to the delight of Mark Sanchez. Who's doing this game again? Two consecutive.
Is he really? The Sanchez is going back home? Okay.
Going home, yeah. The Jets have faced the fourth most runs in the NFL, the second fewest passes. They are holding opponents to 60.5% completion percentage, the second lowest, but their 11.6 yards per completion are ninth highest. So they're not as an elite pass defense as that would make them look. They do have the second highest sack rate in the NFL, in part, it doesn't stand out in terms of volume because they've faced so few passes relatively. Second-year defensive end Will McDonald IV is having a breakout year with 8 sacks after 3 as a rookie. He also ranks 8th among edges in run-stop win rate. So okay. You got the Jets.
Well, that's cool to see. I'm happy to see that Will McDonald's playing well. Yeah. Will McDonald and Quinnen Williams. There's some dudes on this defensive line. Solomon Thomas, Javon Kinlaw, various former Niners, of course. The Jets just don't want this smoke. Aaron Rodgers is not interested in what the Big Cat is bringing. And that's kind of what I was thinking about after that game that they played last week against Kyler Murray, which they shut down Kyler Murray running the ball.
The highest pressure rate of Kyler Murray's career.
Wow. So at the beginning, that was me feeling kind of negative because that's weirdly how I've come out of this. This game, I do not feel negative about. The way that defensive line has been playing, that the secondary has been playing, Reek Woolen, Josh Jobe, right? Devin Witherspoon, basically across the board, just how phenomenal the Seahawks defense has been playing since Ernest Jones got here and Mike McDonald's figured some things out. The thought of Aaron Rodgers having Leonard Williams, Byron Murphy, these pass rushers, right? Derek Hall, Boye Mafe, coming after him, I can see the image in my head of Aaron Rodgers on the ground with his helmet slightly askew, giving a look of like, why the fuck am I still doing this?
I thought I was going to be in the cabinet by now.
Yeah, that there's still time. but that is how I think this game is going to go. We'll see about the offense. I think the Seahawks defense is going to smother the Jets in this game, and Aaron Rodgers in particular. The pass rush, I think, is going to be overwhelming after seeing what they did last week. And I think this is going to be another game that we look at as we've now strung 3 in a row against the NFC West, very solid defensive games. This is going to be the one where they have fun with it. And I remember there's a game, this is at the Giants way back, where it's kind of like, there was a much better Giants team, and the Seahawks defense just crushed Eli. And it was one of those games where you're just like, oh yeah, the defense just went and won it. Offense did well enough. They ended the game early. I think the Seahawks could win this game by a lot. And it's kind of what they need right now as the cherry on top, like I was saying, something happening. If they could win this game by 20, 30 points, all of a sudden that DVOA is going to start looking a lot better. And it's going to set up a real showdown with Arizona in Arizona. And I think this is the week that we really find out where the Seahawks team is at. Are they the team that yards per play were still worse than Arizona, but had the big takeaway and won the game, that eked one out against the Niners, that probably played better than the Rams? Is this the team that is the level higher than that now, where they're able to crush bad teams? Because we did see it at the beginning of the season a little bit, but looking at the Skylar Thompson Dolphins is not quite the same. If they're able to win a game comfortably and also have the offense string together a couple of drives and just score consistently. That's been the thing. They've had some drives, they've moved the ball, and then it's stalled. It's just like, can they just do it over and over and over again and have something really consistent between these three receivers and Ken Walker, hopefully having room to run the ball? I'm feeling very good about this one.
So I gave all those stats. You talked about how good you're feeling about this one. Do you know what the line is for this game?
It's Seahawks minus 1, 2.
1.5.
1.5.
That's kind of wild.
This is how it goes for the Jets, though. This is an Aaron Rodgers line.
Is there still an Aaron Rodgers line?
I think there is. I think Vegas is not not quite convinced on the Seahawks just
Oh,
yet.
Vegas is unquestionably not quite convinced, and you know, neither is the statistics, as I said. Do you want to know the Seahawks' all-time record at MetLife Stadium?
I assume it's quite good. Have they? I'm trying to think of a loss there.
You can't think of one because it hasn't happened. They are 6-0 all time at MetLife Stadium with an average margin of 19.5 points. Their closest win was 27-17 over the Jets in October 2016.
Who started that game?
For the Jets?
Yeah.
That had to be a Zach Wilson game, right? Or is that too far back? I'm
That's
sorry,
way
an
too
Aaron
far back.
Donald game.
Aaron Donald?
I don't know what I'm saying here. Sam Darnold. But it wasn't. It was a Ryan Fitzpatrick game.
Oh, Fitzmagic. That makes sense. Yeah.
That checks out.
Yeah, he's the type of quarterback who loses 27-17.
That's a very Ryan Fitzpatrick score. He threw for his 41 times for 261 yards,
I
but was
actually,
picked off
now
three
that you mentioned
times.
Fitzmagic, I do kind of remember that game.
I can't say I do.
I think we went into it with a healthy bit of concern about Fitzmagic, but this one's going to be different. You're not feeling that same way? Or are you just
No, I
saying
am
that
feeling
Vegas
that same
isn't?
way. It's just
Okay.
kind of wild that, like, you look at the, I mean, because there's so much negativity about the Jets. Like, Aaron Rodgers is having to deny that he wants to play for another team next season. They're having to come out and publicly say that they're not going to shut Aaron Rodgers down.
Oh, I think this might be it. I think there's a good chance that Aaron Rodgers doesn't finish this game and that this is Aaron Rodgers' last game as a
I
Jet.
mean, it's kind of funny because how many games did Brett Favre play as a Jet
Any
after he played
13 or
against the
something?
Sea? No, but against after he played the Seahawks, because that was at the end of that season, right?
Well, yeah, that was the second to last week. You're saying that the
So,
Seahawks could end both Brett Favre and Aaron Rodgers' tenures as Jet?
Favre did start the following week at home, a 24-17 loss to the Miami Dolphins after they lost 13-3 in the snow on December 21st, 2008. That would
I
have been the
remember that.
last win of Mike
I didn't
Holmgren's
go.
career, right?
I didn't go because the snow. That
Yeah.
was the last Mike Holmgren win. Yeah.
Yeah. So,
Well,
quite an
this won't be the
eventful
last Mike
game.
McDonald win.
I sure hope not. I sure hope not.
But yeah, no, I'm feeling very, very good about this game in particular, and about what the Seahawks can do. And again, this to me is like, this is a prove it game. This is a game where it's like it's there for your taking. You played some pretty hard teams 3 weeks in a row. The NFC West, say what you will about them, their records aren't great. All of those games are hard games. Every NFC West game is a hard game. This one shouldn't be as hard of a game. They should be able to go in and crush the Jets in it. And if they do, I think it really means something for where the Seahawks are at overall.
Percentage chances of victory?
I think it's like 78%, maybe even
I'm
higher.
gonna go 70 here. Definitely chance of egg on our faces here, but I mean, I've watched enough of the Jets offense as someone who has Devontae Adams on his fantasy team and is invested in Devontae Adams, and it's like Devontae Adams catch for 0 yards, Devontae Adams catch for
You're
3 yards.
like, I'll take that one half PPR.
Oh, I mean, I will take it, but it is a slog, the Devontae Adams points, let me tell you, sir. So,
Mean, that's part of Aaron Rodgers just is not he doesn't want to get hit at this point. And that Seahawks team, what they did last week, the Jets were on bye last week, right?
yes.
I
So
don't know if that matters,
maybe they
but
developed their chemistry again, Devontae Adams and Aaron Rodgers.
yeah.
Maybe that's what
I'm sure.
Vegas is counting
Chemistry.
on.
No, that is a percentage chance of victory and a belief that there is something happening with the Seahawks team. And I actually secretly think that I think they're going to win this one big, and I think they're going to go into Arizona and win. But we just need to see it play out now. We have to see it on the field.
We always do. On that note,
Thanks for listening.
thanks. Let me tell you,
I didn't
this
even think
year
about
is an
it's the most.
all-time Christmas creep. I which I
No,
s
it's the timing of Thanksgiving.
I agree, yes. I was about to say that. The fact that this is the latest possible Thanksgiving has
You're trying to
encouraged
make the
more creep than
Christmas
ever.
season shorter than ever.
That's not
Your argument right
unfair.
now is for less Christmas.
Yeah, because of the fact that the creep
Oh my.
devalues Christmas.
It
This
doesn't
is a
devalue
love
Christmas.
for Christmas
It's
by
about
anti-creep.
extending the amount of Christmas. If Christmas is good, more Christmas.
No,
is
because
better.
Eventually it'll just be Christmas year round and then it won't be special. That's what makes it special.
This is actually, my argument is actually a capitalistic argument.
Oh, it is a very capitalist argument. It occurred to me the other day, hey, maybe what if we had didn't design it so that our entire financial system required people to spend as much as money as possible during 1 month of the year? Like, I don't know. Maybe that would be a better way.
I mean, I don't think that
But,
it's designed that way. Things happen
fair.
And then it shakes out that
if
way.
It hadn't
Like,
evolved that way.
Yes, the
but you know what the
marketplace
answer is?
Made that happen. What is the answer?
Tariffs.
Nobody will spend any money ever. I was thinking about only small things, though, actually. I was thinking at the Pelton cast, because I was like thinking about the Discord, and so I was talking to somebody else who had a very large podcast, and I was just like, the Pelton cast is intentionally small. Like,
it's boutique.
It's
artisanal.
Like, it's kind of nice having something that's intentionally small. You know, like, it's not like we sit around and lament that there isn't like a larger Pelton cast audience or something, or like we're like looking for a larger Pelton cast audience. We could find a larger Pelton cast audience if we actually wanted to.
I suppose so. To a degree.
I mean,
we'd
have to change what we were doing, but like it
right.
could still be the Pelton cast.
We're capable. I did discuss your NBA takes theory with someone in the league last week, because they were like, hey, why are you holding out on these analytical hot takes you've got? And I explained to him your theory that I needed to come on and be as condescending to people as I am when I talk
That's
to
not a
you.
theory. That's a perspective. Like, a theory is something.
You don't think that's a theory?
The theory is that you would be successful. You would be a more successful podcast guest if you did that. That's the theory. It's not, I have an opinion, not a theory.
I mean, we're getting deep into semantics here.
I thought you were talking
about
something else, though. Like, I thought you were being like, oh, the reason that this is because of this, but no.
He did talk me into a mildly hot take that will be appearing potentially on ESPN.com next week. So
wow,
stay tuned for that. As always, it involves...
ESPN's Kevin Pelton's mildly hot take to most people is just like, I can't even tell if this is a hot take or not.
It involves touting someone else over a player from Seattle, as you can imagine.
Oh,
as it
God.
Always does.
The fuck? If you want a hot take, try going for a possibly unanimous first ballot Hall of Famer who played in the city of Seattle and is beloved by everyone.
There's a different scale to that. But
try hating on that person.
We've already discussed this in the podcast. You don't realize this. But this is a callback to the listener.
Is it?
It is. All right, on that note,
wow.
Thanks for listening for real.
Oh, this is the end of the podcast?
Yes.
Here we are.